unless you understand that history of people. If you're just judging them on race or national origin without understanding why they're here, you can make some real mistakes about how loyal people are to the United States or why they would be interested in serving this country.
And welcome to Insights from Abroad. This podcast is coming to you from the Office of Global Perspectives and International Initiatives within the College of Sciences at the University of Central Florida. Our mission is to support international academic programs at the university. My name is Mia Wilson. I am joined today by Mika Ouyang to discuss her experience and insights as a national security expert. Ms. Ouyang, thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ms. Ouyang is currently the Vice President of the National Security Program of Third Way, a center-left think tank. In the past, she worked in various positions on Capitol Hill. Most recently, Ms. Ouyang served as Chief of Staff to Representative Anna Eshoo. Other positions include Defense Policy Advisor to Senator Ted Kennedy, Subcommittee Staff Director to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, a staffer of the House Armed Services Committee, and Legislative Assistant for Representative Pat Schroeder. She has worked with all aspects of national security throughout her career. Further, Ms. Ouyang received her Juris Doctor from the University of California, Hastings College of the Law, and graduated from Wellesley College. So my first question is, when did you decide you wanted to pursue a career in national security?
So sort of an accident. I didn't actually think that I wanted to pursue a career in national security, but after my first internship, I discovered that I really enjoyed working in Congress. And so when I graduated from college, the position that was open to me and was offered to me was one handling national security. And when I started working in the area, I found out that it was really fascinating. National security and the military in particular is a microcosm of society. So every issue that you have in society, issues of racism, issues of healthcare, issues of how much do you spend, all of those issues are there with the military. And then on top of that, you have these foreign policy issues. When you deploy military, when do you go to war, all of these things. And so it was just really interesting. And so I wound up sticking with it the rest of my career. It was kind of an accident.
And who was your first internship with that you found your love for, like, working in Congress?
So I worked for a congresswoman named Pat Schroeder, who used to represent Denver, Colorado, but now she lives here in Florida. And she was really a groundbreaking member of Congress. She was one of the first women to run for Congress or run for president. And she really did a lot of work to try and change the way that society thinks about things. She fought very hard to get women the right to serve on ships and in combat aviation in the military. She did a lot of work on copyright law. She was one of the House authors of the Violence Against Women Act. There were all these things that she worked on that we take for granted today, but she really had a belief in her ability to change the world and did amazing work at that.
That's amazing. And for your career at Third Way, what exactly is your position and what are your duties?
So I run the National Security Program at Third Way, which is a center-left think tank in Washington, and our focus is helping members of Congress understand what Congress can do in national security. So that's different than what the president does. You know, the president negotiates treaties with other countries or decides whether or not to go to war, and they're the commander-in-chief of the military. Congress's role is different. They approve the budgets for the military, they conduct oversight, and so the kinds of things that they do to affect the direction of the country is very different. Since I spent my career working in Congress, I can help them understand what kinds of things have been done before and what kinds of tools and tactics they can use to advance their own policy agendas.
You advise these congressmen on a variety of different issues, and how would you describe how large your impact is on such policy decisions that are made in Congress regarding to national security?
So it's hard to tell how big any person's influence is, and you don't want to take too much credit for things that where you're sort of convincing other people to do things. One of the things that I think about in terms of my role is that I'm helping people understand what they can do and helping bring clarity to the challenges that they face. So members of Congress will often call me and ask me to come in and help them think about how to approach various crisis points with the administration. So if the administration is coming in to brief them on a potential military action with another country and the threat that is posed to our country, they'll ask me, okay, well, what kinds of questions do I need to ask? What do I need to know from this briefing? how do I understand what my responsibility is here? A lot of members of Congress are new to the job and they've never worked in national security before. Mm-hmm. They don't really understand what their tools are or what's at stake here. And so what they need is help asking really good questions. And I'm not here to try and tell them you should or shouldn't do something. What mm-hmm. I try and do is say, here are your choices and here are some likely consequences of the particular paths that you could go down. And that really helps them, I think, see the differences in what's going on.
And are you working with all of the members of Congress, or is it usually just particular people?
Yeah, so my organization, we're a center-left think tank, which means that we work mostly with centrist Democrats. Those are mm-hmm. Democrats who represent purple or swing districts. They tend to be a little bit more conservative. This is one of those areas. Stephanie Murphy, who represents this area, she has a district like that where you can't just pick the most liberal thing and adopt that policy, but you have to listen to a wide range of constituents. So we help them think about how you talk to that group of people. And those constituents in those purple areas have a different take on security than people in very blue areas.
And I had one question regarding actual policy. You mentioned in a piece you wrote for the Washington Examiner, you address flaws in Section 702. And can you expand upon how the authority of the NSA can be reformed to protect the rights of Americans while still promoting national security?
Yeah, so this is actually a really complicated area and one of the areas where I spend a lot of time helping members of Congress understand because it's technical and really complicated. Mm-hmm. So for those people who don't know, Section 702 authorizes our government to conduct electronic surveillance of people overseas, meaning that they are collecting people's emails and phone calls and text messages and all kinds of other things. Because they're looking for information on threats outside the United States, people who might work for another foreign intelligence service, they might be terrorists plotting a thing. Section 702 allows two kinds of collection, or when we wrote it, it allows two kinds of collection against people outside the United States. One is a group of people that we have identified by their, what we call selectors, their email addresses or phone mm-hmm. numbers, as affiliated with certain kinds of national security threat activity. WMD, meaning they're sort of involved in the trafficking of weapons of mass destruction. They could be plotting terrorist attacks. They could be working as spies for other countries. Those people, those numbers and accounts associated with them are targeted for collection. So you get a lot of information on those particular kinds of information. The other kind of collection that 702 authorizes is what they call bulk collection, which would have allowed the government to collect not the content of the communication, but we think of it as like the outside envelope information. The to-from information, the metadata of communications, so that you could see who was talking to who. And it collects all of that information outside the United States and allows the government to run all kinds of analysis on that information, not to see what people are saying, but to see when and where people are communicating. In this world of interconnectedness and when you always have your phone on you, the metadata can be an incredibly powerful tool to be able to allow you to single out particular threats and do network analysis. The problem with that is that Americans don't just stay home. We mm-hmm. travel all over the world. And some Americans even live overseas. And so the phone number may or may not belong to an American. It's very difficult to know if mm-hmm. that's the only information that you have, whether or not that person, that number is affiliated with someone who actually deserves constitutional protections. Our Constitution says that the government needs a reason and a permission slip to be able to collect that information on you. It's called, people have heard this, get a warrant. Mm-hmm. You need to get a warrant to look at an American. So part of the challenge is that because it's collecting the foreign end of the communication, and those people might be calling people in the United States, Americans' communications are getting swept up, what we call incidentally collected, mm-hmm. as part of that information. And so Americans' privacy could be implicated if they're just talking to someone. Say they have a cousin who's studying abroad, or they have a grandmother who lives in a different country. All that communication gets swept up. Well, the Americans, both inside the United States and while traveling, deserve the protection of a warrant. So one of the things that we were really advocating for was that the government, when they were looking for the information that was an American, that they would have to get a warrant. And this is especially important in, say, terrorism cases. Mm-hmm. Someone is having conversations with a known terrorist cell abroad, but what you really want to know about is the American end, because it's at the American end of that phone conversation that they could actually engage in a plot to harm Americans, as we saw Jacksonville Naval Air Station a few months ago. You want to be able to know who the threats are inside the United States to be able to protect Americans. Mm-hmm. But you need to be able to get a warrant, because the Constitution requires a certain amount of protection. The government can't just listen to everyone and then sort out later what mm-hmm. they think is a threat or not a threat. And so that's one of the things in this Section 702 that we think is really important. It's about the basic privacy protections to prevent a big brother-like government from putting us under constant surveillance.
And do you feel at this time in Congress it's possible to introduce such legislation to reform 702?
So we had an opportunity to do it a few years ago. Section 702 is a piece of legislation that has what we call a sunset. So it expires every 5 years, or depending on when Congress puts it in. So the next time to reform that will be when it expires again. So mm-hmm. it's something that people think about a lot now, but they're not necessarily going to have an opportunity to move it until later when the current iteration expires.
And how do you use your position at Third Way to maybe talk to members of Congress about this when the time does come?
Yeah, so we've written a lot of pieces on this for the last reauthorization, which some of which you've seen. We put together little flow charts with graphics in them. We've put together little videos to help it become easier for people to understand what's at stake here. And then we'll go in and brief members of Congress and talk to them about exactly what is at stake here in the law and what the changes mean. And I expect that we would get asked to do that again. I'm one of the few people who talks about this issue who was actually involved in the creation of this program at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Most of the people who are concerned about this program haven't had that experience of what the value is of the communications and the collection to identifying terrorist threats. And so it's important that even as you protect Americans, you're not getting in the way of making sure that we can identify the threats to America and try and stop them or bring them to justice if they actually are successful.
And that's very interesting. And now I want to take a moment to step away from the actual policy side, mm-hmm. and I wanted to discuss that you've said in the past that the intelligence community does tend to fall behind in terms of diversity. Mm-hmm. And so how do you use your position as a woman who is an expert in intelligence and national security to combat that?
Yeah, so I think that there are a lot of people in the intelligence community who have a lot of suspicion of people who have foreign connections. Mm-hmm. Because I think that there is a worry, and this is a legitimate worry, that people who have connections to people in other countries could have pressure brought to bear on them to spy for those other countries. And so mm-hmm. there's this real suspicion there. But a lot of people who have come to this country and have immigrated to this country really embrace America, and just because another country might try doesn't mean that they're automatically spies. And people who come from other countries or have mm-hmm. family in other countries also have a better cultural understanding of those countries and may have connections to those countries that are valuable if we are asking our people to help understand those countries and what's at stake there. When I served on the Intelligence Committee, we really pushed the community, the intelligence agencies, to hire more diverse people, in part because if somebody who is working in intelligence in, say, China, and they look like you instead of looking like me, when you walk down the street, you stick out like a sore thumb. Whereas if I walk down the street, it's much easier for me to pass unnoticed mm-hmm. or lose someone who is trying to follow me, or having someone just not really notice that I am, in fact, they don't assume that I'm American. And I'd heard this from other intelligence officers who were from the ethnic background of the places that they were working, and they would say, oh, people would just forget that they were American, and they would just start talking as if they were among just their own people, and the American in the room, because they didn't distinguish them, they weren't distinguished visually, got to hear all that information. And there's also a sense of trust. Now, right, the intelligence agency has a whole bunch of different functions, and you need different kinds of people to have different roles in it. Mm-hmm. But there is a real value for people who are diverse to be able to do different things. to upend people's expectations of what an American looks like and who an American is. And so I think you want to have that diversity so you have those options. But we're not there. We're not where we need to be in terms of thinking about that. And I also think that people who have diverse backgrounds, you want to have a variety of perspectives and opinions in the room, mm-hmm. because otherwise you fall victim to groupthink and people don't question each other's assumptions and you could really miss something. Whereas if you have a whole bunch of people who approach a problem differently, you're more likely to uncover the flaws in your thinking.
And has the lack of diversity in this field ever impacted you as in your career? I know you didn't really work necessarily for the exact intelligence community, but you worked in Congress.
So it's hard to know whether or not diversity has adversely impacted your career. I do think that there have been points where people, you know, have made assumptions about me based on my ethnic origin, mm-hmm. And my race that aren't true. And mm-hmm. I think if they understood more of the geopolitical history of why my family's in the United States, they wouldn't assume that I had any sympathy for the Chinese government at all, given that unless you understand that history of people, if you're just judging them on race or national origin without understanding why they're here, the regime in power. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know that geopolitical history, you might assume that someone has some sympathy for that country. Mm-hmm. You know, you see that particularly in the Cuban American population, but also the Chinese American and Vietnamese American populations here. Right? They fled a place where they were no longer welcome and their lives were at risk from governments that were very autocratic to a place where they had the freedom to participate, to earn a good living, and to try and succeed. And so unless you understand that history of people, if you're just judging them on race or national origin without understanding why they're here, you can make some real mistakes about how loyal people are to the United States or why they would be interested in serving this country.
Oh. And then what steps must the community make in order to improve? And is the issue rooted in the community itself, or is it more focused on individuals, would you say?
I think that there are some real assumptions in the community about what an American looks like and mm-hmm. what that means. I think that if the community puts a value on diversity, on having lots of different opinions, and I don't just mean like making sure that racial representation is higher in the community, mm-hmm. but thinking about people who have different kinds of backgrounds, who understand what the target set is thinking, who might challenge their own assumptions, who might come at it from a different perspective, and thinks about putting together a mosaic of opinions in the room, mm-hmm. and saw that as a value towards being effective at the mission, then you'd see a lot more diversity in the community, even at the highest levels. And I think that part of the challenge is that suspicion of people being and suspicion that people might be loyal to where they came from as opposed to being loyal to America really hinders people's ability to advance in the community. But then if at the highest levels everybody looks the same, they make the same mistakes. And we really saw, this happened in the 1950s after the Communist Revolution in China, the intelligence community purged a lot of its, or the vast majority of its China experts, and thought they were disloyal and got rid of them, both the State Department and the intelligence community. Mm-hmm. And the challenge with that is then you didn't have people who understood Chinese society and culture and what the opportunities were. And so in America, in our foreign policy, we do a lot of imposing our views on other countries, telling other countries they should do it our way, as opposed to listening to them about what their way is and how do we bridge that gap. That lack of empathy really hinders American foreign policy making, and I think some more diversity would make us more empathetic.
That's very interesting. In a past interview, you stated that the best outcome in national security is not always the most popular outcome. So what is an example of this unpopular piece of national security legislation that you were faced with talking to members of Congress with during your time at Third Way?
That is a really good question. So I think that it's very unpopular, the idea that the U.S. would intervene militarily in the Middle East, specifically in Syria. And because I think Americans are really tired of getting involved in yet another war in the Middle East. But sometimes you're involved in a situation where not getting involved means that the situation's just going to continue to get worse. Mm-hmm. And getting involved early to change the flow of the situation can avoid that degradation. Mm-hmm. And I think that that was the debate that the Obama administration really struggled with. The key is to have an exit strategy and a plan for what your involvement is going to be and how to get out of it. Mm-hmm. I think that engagement in Syria was really unpopular. But in many cases, it's the right thing to do. And America drags its feet a lot. America dragged its feet on getting into World War II. And there are a lot of people who feel like if America had gotten in earlier, that there were some tremendous human consequences that could have been either lessened or avoided if we had moved more quickly. So sometimes it's the unpopular thing. But we don't actually know, because you can't go back and have a redo of it, whether or not it would have in fact worked. We just sort of continue to move forward. Another example of an unpopular thing is the U.S. policy towards Cuba. Mm-hmm. Right, there are a lot of things where the right thing to do is probably to lift the embargo and encourage Cuba to be a more democratic, market-based economy by having people travel there. Mm-hmm. But the president seems to think it's popular, at least among a certain group of people, to continue to wall off Cuba until they buckle, when it's very clear that that embargo and the isolation of Cuba has kept the regime in power for a much longer time than they might have otherwise.
Very interesting. And I have one question that's a little bit centered towards current events. It's not super current, but nonetheless. There's reports of Jeff Bezos' phone being hacked by the Saudi government. And what message would you want to emphasize in regards to cybersecurity with this news?
Well, first, maybe do not give your phone number to foreign leaders, period. Let them call you if you're a wealthy tycoon. Perhaps let them call you through your assistant or something, so that they don't have access to your phones directly. Mm-hmm. But also, I think it really points out the danger of people clicking on links and making connections with people where they don't really know what their history is. Jeff Bezos can afford to run the forensics on his phone to figure out how he has been hacked. Most people can't do that. Mm-hmm. They're just really vulnerable out there. But I don't know that you can take enough security precautions to ever prevent yourself from being hacked, unless you don't have a cell phone and you're not connected to the internet. The only way is sort of like the boy in the bubble approach, where it's like you're not really touching anything. Mm-hmm. But then you don't get to participate in all the benefits of technology. So I think there is a real risk there. I think people should be careful about putting their personal information on the internet. Sensitive photographs or messages, and be much more wary of what they're sharing and with whom. I would also discourage people from, or I would encourage people to know the origins of the platforms on which they're sharing information. Right? People may remember that app that aged people's faces. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that was a Russian app, and they were collecting a huge amount of facial recognition data on people. TikTok is a Chinese company. When you install an app like that, it tracks your whereabouts, it tracks your usage patterns, it learns an awful lot about you. And so I think people should be really careful about what they're sharing and with whom and what platforms they're using.
And so we're kind of discussing now privacy and how to make sure that you aren't maybe, like, the Russian government isn't collecting your facial data. I'm sure you saw the report in the New York Times about the app that can basically just take a picture of your face and then find where you live. And mm-hmm. How would you relate that to such?
So I do think that we are in an age where technology will make it very difficult to have any sense of privacy at all. which is why, going back to our conversation about Section 702, it's really important that we as Americans advocate for and demand from our government restrictions on how they can use that technology. That all that information is out there, and just because it is technically capable for them to be able to use technology in a certain way doesn't mean that they should. And frankly, even if it's legally permissible at the edges of the law that they use technology a certain way, that doesn't mean for policy reasons they should. Mm-hmm. There is a sense in our country that government should be limited. People should be allowed to live their lives without government interference, as long as they're not hurting anybody. And so the government should have to articulate a reason that they need to look for people's information. And they have to be able to articulate that reason to a neutral third party, usually the courts, to be able to say, here's my reason, and the court should be able to look at it and say, yep, I agree that that's a valid reason. Here is your permission slip to be able to go access that technology. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we're fully there yet because we don't understand all the ways in which technology can be used to identify people. And in the wrong hands, in a government that does not restrain itself or believe in the Constitution or the laws, the real risk is that they will use technology in ways to target people who disagree with them. Mm-hmm. And make their lives very difficult.
Now, in regards to the phone hack, I wanted to relate that to a piece of news that's less current, but after the GOP members of Congress stormed the Intelligence Committee's SCIF, you wrote a viral Twitter thread about it. In this thread, you mentioned foreign adversaries may target members of Congress, such as for access to the SCIF. How would you relate that to Jeff Bezos being hacked to warn members of Congress?
Yeah, so look, I think that foreign intelligence services are really interested in all kinds of powerful people whose decisions affect the direction of the world. And members of Congress are those kinds of people. And frankly, they want to look for information that would make those people vulnerable to pressure or to blackmail, right? So if members of Congress or Jeff Bezos or whoever are having extramarital affairs or texting racy pictures and the foreign intelligence services get a hold of things that they don't want out in the public, then they have reasons to do things on behalf of the people who are holding that vulnerable information in ways that are not about the national interest and our collective interest, but about what those foreign adversaries want. So part of the challenge on the lack of privacy is that everything that you do, all your deepest, darkest secrets, everything you put into your search history, everything you look at, somebody knows. Someone knows what that is because they are monetizing that history for their own purposes. And so you have to really appreciate that we are being watched all the time. It's a little disconcerting, and it sort of makes people behave very differently in that sense. But both members of Congress and other powerful people, journalists, celebrities, wealthy individuals, some kinds of scientists may have foreign intelligence services interested in what they are working on and what they are doing and looking for vulnerabilities to try and convince those people to work for those countries instead of for America.
And in regards to cybersecurity, cyber policy, you spoke at the 2019 RSA conference in regards to U.S. cyber policy. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, is the United States on track?
No, I don't think it is. Look, we have some real strategic cybersecurity challenges right now. I think everyone's very concerned that the 2020 elections will be hacked. We know that the Russians tried to interfere in the 2016 election and could try again in 2020. We also know that 1 in 4 American households has been the victim of cybercrime. We know that the Chinese are stealing intellectual property from American companies to be able to replicate it and, you know, making it very difficult for those companies to continue to be profitable or to make new technologies. We know that cities across this country are being hit by ransomware. And at the same time, the government is not developing a comprehensive strategy on how it's going to deal with cybersecurity and be able to punish them, identify and punish and hold accountable the people who are conducting those attacks on the United States. And we need to think a lot more about it. And that's something that involves many different government agencies, and without a comprehensive attention at it from the top, meaning at the White House, with a consistent plan, those agencies will not be able to work together to address this threat.
And so obviously you believe that cyber policy is very integral to national security. And so do you believe that cyber policy should be a bigger aspect of the campaign platforms of the 2020 candidates on either side of the aisle?
Absolutely. Cybersecurity is one of the few areas where a hostile adversary sitting abroad in another country can just push a button and harm Americans who are going about their business here inside the United States. Mm-hmm. They could shut down a cancer clinic, and so people couldn't get needed cancer treatments. They could interfere with 911 emergency response systems. They could shut down a banking system so that people, you know, wind up not able to make payroll or things like that. Mm-hmm. This is a threat that affects all aspects of American life, and we really need to be talking about it. The next American president really needs to grapple with this, because it's very clear that it's beyond the capability of the current president to be able to develop and sustain a consistent plan for response.
Do you believe there's any aspect, which could include cyber policy, that you feel is often ignored or overlooked by American public and by the current administration that should be more, like, noticed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in cybersecurity we spend a lot of time talking about the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, the North Koreans, who are stealing the data, OPM, the federal employees' personal information and things like that. Mm-hmm. People spend a lot of time focusing on that, and we tend to ignore cybercrime, the places where people are having their money stolen out of their bank accounts, fraudulent account charges on their credit cards. Everyone gets all those phone calls where your social security number has been compromised. There are people behind those attacks. Those people are making millions of dollars off of Americans, and they're especially targeting seniors who are very gullible when they get those attacks. The United States needs to do a much better job of figuring out who those people are and bringing them to justice, but we have been really far behind in going after the digital robbers. I wrote a piece in the Baltimore Sun called Analog Cops, Digital Robbers, and it is really true that law enforcement, for the most part, is still operating in an analog world where they secure a crime scene and they're talking about digital fingerprints and they're doing things that are in person the way that they've always done it, and don't really know how to grapple with this world of online crime where, right, we're seeing all kinds of horrible things happening to people. From invasions of privacy and digital stalking to theft and interference with essential services. We've got to get better at investigating and prosecuting those cyber crimes.
And my final question is, do you feel the United States has a national security plan and policy which is well suited for the 21st century?
No, I don't. I think that our national security plans are really backwards looking. They were developed after the end of World War II, and they worked for a really long time. But after the Soviet Union collapsed and the Cold War ended, there were a whole bunch of other challenges, and we didn't really know what they were, and we don't know how to work together globally to resolve them. We're still operating off of those old systems, and so we don't have a policy that allows us to address the real threats of what's to come. For example, our military keeps talking about they need to be able to fight two simultaneous wars. Well, I don't know that the American people are up for two simultaneous wars, and actually we're fighting two simultaneous wars right now, one in Afghanistan and one against ISIS in Iraq. But maybe that's not the thing that actually threatens the safety and welfare of the American people, and we should rethink what we need to do for the 21st century. There are a lot of problems that are bigger than America's ability to solve and can't be solved with the military. For example, climate change. You can't fight your way to a more secure planet.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Ms. Ouyang, I would like to take this time to thank you for being here and for sharing your experience with us. For more information on today's guest or our program, please visit us at ucfglobalperspectives.org. I am Mia Wilson, and on behalf of the Office of Global Perspectives and International Initiatives at UCF, thank you for listening.